Welcome to the UP Notable Books Club, brought to you by the Upper Peninsula Publisher and Authors Association. Sue Harrison was raised in Michigan's Upper Peninsula and lives in Pickford with her husband Neil, a retired high school principal. A graduate of Pickford High School and Lake Superior State University, Harrison was named an LSSU Distinguished Alumna and served 8 years on the university's Board of Regents. She was an adjunct instructor of creative writing and advanced creative writing and worked in the Public Relations Department as the university writer and acting department head. She has written 6 novels set in ancient Alaska. Her other novels include Sisu, a National Advanced Reader's Book, and The Midwife's Touch, which was selected as a semi-finalist in the 2023 Society of Midland Authors National Literary Awards Adult Fiction Competition. It was also an Amazon Top 10 bestseller and named a 2024 Upper Peninsula Notable Book. In 2023, she was inducted into the Upper Peninsula Literary Hall of Fame.
I am Evelyn here from the Crystal Falls Library, and this is Dorothy Bailey. Hi. Have read the book, and that's why we are here tonight to do The Midwife's Touch with Sue Harrison. And we are so glad that she's here, and we feel that we've maybe ironed out all of the technical glitches. Usually at this point, before Sue starts, so she can take a deep breath, because it's been a little hairy the last 7 minutes, we usually have Victor say some words. Victor. I have lost Victor. Oh, there's Victor.
Hi, my name is Victor Volkman. I am the current president of the Upper Peninsula Publishers and Authors Association. And if you were watching TV6 Marquette this week, you may have seen me for about 8 seconds talking about the Dandelion Cottage Short Story Contest, which is now underway. So if you have a son, daughter, niece, nephew, grandchild, or whatever, who is in the grades 5 through 12 in the UP schools, they're eligible to join the short story contest. There's no charge whatsoever, and the prizes go all the way up to $250. And the point of it is to recognize the excellence in student writers. So the students work with their teacher, and the teacher will eventually submit the work up to our website. And then at January 31st, we'll close the contest and we'll begin judging all of the student submissions. And we'll pick a first and second and third place winner for the high school students, and first, second, third winners for the grades 5 through 8 students. So it's a great opportunity for kids to get their writing skills recognized. And there's also a traveling trophy, like our Stanley Cup of UP writers, that they get to have at their school for a whole year. And they'll get a copy of the UP Reader, which will feature their story. So all those student winner stories, first, second, and third place, will be featured in the UP Reader coming out in April 2025. So it's just an amazing experience. And I wish we could get all the students to submit stories. Of course, we need a lot more jurors. Well, that's it for me. I'll hand it back over to Evelyn for just a few seconds.
Sure. Just a few seconds. Last bit of what you call paperwork business is we are wrapping up the 2024 season of the UP Notable Books Book Club. So we've got Sue Harrison with us tonight, like I previously mentioned. And then next month, we are going to be discussing a UP Notable classic entitled Death's Door, The Truth Behind the Italian Hall Disaster and the Strike of 1913. Now, for this book club discussion, we will not be speaking with the author. It will be just a book club discussion amongst all the members. So please get a copy of the book so you will be, you know, ready for the discussion. I think I have to double check the calendar, but which I can do right now. It is going to be on December, I think it's the 12th. Yep, I'm right, December the 12th. So we will meet to talk about that. And Victor and I have been speaking a lot this week about how we're going to move into the 2025 season. And what we're going to do is, because the UP Notable Books list gets announced on January 3rd, our first meeting should be January 9th. That's not going to give us enough time to read the book. So we're going to have a winter break. So we have the month of January off, but I will be writing you with the schedule, because once January 3rd hits and I get the list of all the books. I talk quick to the authors and we start putting the calendar together. So as soon as I get somebody booked in February, I will let you know so you can start reading that book. And then once the calendar is all the way finalized, of course, you'll get that too. Am I forgetting anything, Victor?
No, I think that covers all the business.
All right, business done. Now the fun. Sue Harrison, what a gift. We are so lucky to have you, international bestseller, as our speaker tonight. And this book is amazing. I can't wait to hear you tell me more about it.
Thank you. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. You should have a slide on your screen with the Lauren Gilswelder books. Do you see that slide? Is that up? Or are you seeing me?
No, that looks great.
Good. All right. I thought I would do a thumbnail presentation of how I got started in writing and then go into the book. When I was 10 years old, I was visiting my grandparents downstate, and I was a very spoiled child, evidently, and getting on my grandmother's nerves. And she went upstairs to one of her magic, huge walk-in closets, and she brought me back down a book, The Little House in the Big Woods. It was the first, my introduction to Lauren Gilswelder books. And that weekend, which was rainy and dreary, and there were lots of kids there, and I was the oldest, I started reading that book. Then at that next Christmas, Grandma and Grandpa sent me the first Little House book. And you see how tattered those books were in that previous slide. I received a book every Christmas through these happy golden years. And I bought On the Way Home myself because it was published quite a bit later. It was the first time I realized that words could put pictures in my mind. And it just, that awe, the awesomeness of that just blew me away. And I decided I was going to be a writer, and I was going to write novels. And I started immediately and turned out a lot of junky stuff. Went to Lake State, obtained an English degree, which I don't believe you need to have to be a writer, but I needed it. And I was very vain. And because I was a really good writer in Pickford High School, I assumed I'd be a really classy, good writer at Lake State, and soon found out in my freshman English class that I wasn't. There were a lot of people that were better than me. I didn't even know what a haiku was. And I remember being so afraid and sitting in the back of the class, my heart just thumping because I thought, oh, they're so far ahead of me. As I progressed through college, I did hone my skills and I had some incredible professors. But I decided one thing, I was never going to be as good as some writers were. But I knew I was a hard worker and I loved history. And I thought, if I ever want to get a book published, if I'm willing to do far and above the amount of work for research, perhaps I will get a book published. So that's what I started to do. When I was 28 years old, our son, Neil Jr., started kindergarten. Our daughter was 3, and she was a very quiet child, would play beside me. And I started doing research. And I begged, borrowed. There was no internet in those days, this late 70s, like I said. And I started taking notes. And 4 years later, I had 400 pages of handwritten notes. And finally, one day, I looked at that big, thick thing and thought, I've got to start writing. I can research the rest of my life. I did hands-on research, like how to make stuff out of stuff. And I hunkered down in our Upper winters and lost myself in the joy of writing. My office assistant was always with me. This is my most recent office assistant. Obviously, she wasn't there back in the early 80s. My husband was my great support system. This is Neil. This is back in the 1990s. And this was our first trip to the Aleutian Islands. This is at Dutch Harbor. He's a photographer, actually had some of his beautiful photographs published in Japan in their magazine that corresponds to our National Geographic. And one of the pictures that was in that magazine, he was leaning over the top of a cliff on the Pribilof Islands, and I was sitting on his feet so he wouldn't fall. And he took pictures of puffins in their holes. It was pretty, pretty cool. Well, anyway, finally the book was done and I started sending that out. And I spent 5 long, miserable years, during which time I was also working at Lake State as a PR writer and then as the department head. And nobody wanted Mother or Father Sky. No publishers. And they all said, you've got to get an agent. I bought a book. This was no internet days. And a book that was United States and Canadian agents A through Z. I started in the A's and started sending out query letters. I was finally in the W's. Lots of rejections. And sent a letter in November of 1988 to an agent named Rhoda Weyer, whom I had not ever heard of, but she seemed to be interested in finding new voices. And I didn't realize at that time that you don't send stuff to New York in November and December because nobody's there. But nonetheless, I did. And nonetheless, bless her heart, she asked to read the manuscript. And I sent it to her in December. I had just sent a query and some pages. And in January, I received a phone call. I was home. Because my daughter was homesick from school. She was 13 at the time, into the teenage angst kind of stuff. And she was a type A, she's still a type A person just like me, and wanted to go back. She was good enough in the afternoon. I think I can make it. And I needed to drive her to school 6 miles away. So we were just walking out the door and the phone rang. You know, it's one of those hang the phone on the wall things with a big long cord. And she was angry because I picked it up and answered it. It was Rhoda Weyer. And she said, I absolutely love your book and I want to represent you. And so I am just stunned. And I sat down at the kitchen table because the cord would reach that far, grabbed a pen and paper and wrote down the few corrections she asked of me. I had no idea still who she was. She was the agent in New York City who broke the glass ceiling at William Morrow, a woman literary agent. And she had done that 20 years before, probably. And so eventually we ended our conversation. My daughter was furious. I got her to school before the bell rang. And now she laughs about it because as an adult, she knows. At that point in my life, it was the most important phone call I ever received. I heard nothing after I did the corrections, which only took me 3 or 4 days. I heard nothing until end of March, beginning of April. And I was just thinking, oh, I should have come clean with Rhoda Weyer and told her, you know, this book has been rejected by so many people. You really don't want to put your heart and soul into this mess of trying to get somebody to publish it. She called me and she said, Sue, you're going to receive some phone calls. And just from some publishers who might be interested, please be yourself. You're just, I know you're from Michigan. I know you're from the Upper Peninsula. You've just had a very laid back life. Just be who you are. Don't try to be sophisticated, which was very good advice, especially for me, since that's not my strength. And the next day I told my husband, he said, don't get your hopes up. We know how much this has been rejected. The next day I received a phone call. I was home by myself. It was from Joni Evans. She was president of Random House. And I think that whole phone call, I was in shock. She wanted me to be willing to add a lot of description. which I felt would drown the story. But when Joni Evans, president of Random House, asked you to do something like that, and you're Sue who? Harrison from where? Pickford, Michigan. You're going to say yes. And I did. And the next, I told my husband that night, he says, still, don't get your hopes up. This probably, you know how many times we've had rejections. So next day, we were both home, morning coffee break, sitting at our square oak table in the kitchen. Phone rings. I reach up and snag it off the wall and snake the cord over my shoulder. And the woman introduces herself as Loretta Barrett. She is a senior vice president of Doubleday. And Neil grabbed me a pen and a piece of paper, and I'm taking notes, and he can only hear my side of the conversation. And after a while, I look over at him across the table, and he's crying. He has tears coming down his face because he finally realized that it was Loretta Barrett trying to invite me and encourage me to choose Doubleday. It wasn't me trying to get Loretta to buy my book. And he's sitting there just saying, my crazy wife, who has been working on this book since 1978, is going to be published. Well, it was published. Rhoda Wire put it at auction. There were five bidders. The auction goes in rounds, and later, if question and answer, you want more info about that, I'll be glad to share it. Third day, we still had three groups in the auction, including both Random House and Doubleday. Doubleday offered the most money, but that wasn't the main thing for me. It was the $100,000 guarantee for PR work behind the scenes. That money wouldn't come to me, but it would go out to do the work on publicizing the book. And so in 1990, Mother of Father Sky came out from Doubleday, and our lives changed. We began to travel. Rhoda sold the book in at least 25 countries, 13 different languages. We were flown to Japan by my Japanese publisher, Shōinshō. We went to Europe. We were just all over the United States and Canada on book tours. I had worked at a little tiny college in PR, and I'm so grateful for that because I had done radio shows and television shows, and I needed that experience. But that was, you know, nothing compared to what this turned out to be. And I'm sure I had my foot in my mouth a lot of times, but people were kind and people were interested. And eventually I wrote five more books set in ancient Alaska. The first trilogy is the Ivory Carver trilogy, and the second is the Storyteller trilogy. And they are still out there as audiobooks and as Kindle books, and Mother of Father Sky is out there as a print book for a while yet, anyway. My world fell apart in about 2001. The Twin Towers were bombed. Rhoda retired and moved out of New York City, said, we're gone, I'm done. And she had watched the towers fall from her bathroom window. And she and her husband, who is Fred Kaplan, he's an incredible writer. His most recent book is his Masterly Pen, which is not a biography of Thomas Jefferson. His work is beyond words. And Rhoda passed away a couple of years ago. She sold her business back then in 2002 to a wonderful woman who was a children's book agent, who was really not at all interested in my work. And so at the same time, my husband's parents started needing daily care, and that fell on my shoulders. My mother-in-law had Alzheimer's. She had to be spoon-fed. She was in diapers. There were very few places we could put her. It turned out that for the next 16 years, I was their daily caregiver. It was difficult. It was heartbreaking. It destroyed my career. What I wrote was awful. And what I was just thinking, you know, was one day I was sitting in their bathroom and I was cleaning their toilet for probably the 10th time that day. And I was thinking, I used to stand up in front of 600 people and give a talk. I used to fly to Japan, you know, and go to fancy restaurants. And now I'm scrubbing toilets. But you know what? Sometimes in your life, you have this need to give. So many people have given so much for me. Sometimes it's easier to let your own heart be broken than to break the heart of someone you love. So for 16 years, I took care of them. And during that time, my parents moved back to Pickford. My dad's home state is Arkansas. So when he retired, they moved back there, but back to Pickford because my mother also had Alzheimer's. The year that my mother-in-law died, they moved back and I began taking care of them. They did not need daily care. And they eventually did go into a home, my father because he went blind, and my mother because she had a disease much like ALS, and we could no longer move her, even though she was tiny. And I started to have time to write again. And I started the research again. And I decided to write about a young woman named China Creed, who lived in the mid-1800s and who had a magical gift that by touch she could grant wishes. And she was a midwife. And I worked on that book for about 3 or 4 years. You see, I got smarter and I was able to write books faster than with mother or father's gift. And the midwife's touch came out in 2023. It's a joint publication. We have our own little publishing house. We call it Shanty Cove Books. But the company that brings out all my Alaska books, they decided that they wanted to brings out my Alaska books as audio and as through Audible, and brings them out as Kindle books. They decided they wanted a trilogy, and I started working on the trilogy. And the book came out. It has lovely reviews. It was a much smaller press situation, but you know, it's just right for my age and my time. And after all those years, and I did all kinds of PR stuff of bookmarks and coffee cups and all this thing. And then this most wonderful thing happened. It was chosen as a UP Notable Books. Thank you so much, Victor. Which opened the book up to so many more people. And I am here today because of that. And I'm so delighted to be with all of you. And I've been so delighted all this year to be with all of you through all the 2024 notable books that were chosen. So that's my story in a nutshell. I hope I didn't take too long. And now I'm really, really open for questions and answers. I don't know how to get my face back on the screen, but anyway, that's not a big problem. So questions. No question.
I'll ask one.
Go ahead, Terry.
I was so impressed with this book and the research you did. At first, I read the book before I got to the, I think it was in the back where you explained so many things. And I'm like, how does she know all this stuff? I mean, or is she making it up? I mean, because a lot of authors just sort of, you get things throughout life and you assume things. Uh-oh.
There I am.
Did I break it?
No.
Okay. Anyway, I just wondered, you explained a lot of things in the back of the book that were incorporated in, and I don't have the books. I got it from the library and had to take it back. But how long did you do that research as you went, or did you do all of that research and then start the book?
Unlike with Mother of Father Sky, I did enough research to make a foundation. And so that's about a year of research, particularly with the midwife information. And I had the great advantage of knowing Missouri quite well because of my father's family who lived in the eastern side in the boot heel of Missouri and into Arkansas. So I have cousins all over creation in that area and in the Ozarks area in both Missouri and Arkansas. So all these things were in my head. One of the hardest things for me to develop for Mother Earth, Father Sky was the voice of the book. And I studied native languages to do that, to get the rhythm of the words. Well, I already had the voice of this book, and it was my grandpa's voice. He lived until I was 44. So I had the great advantage of having that grandpa with me for many, many years. And he had the softest, most beautiful, deep voice. And it was that Missouri accent. And he did not lose it, unlike my grandmother, who lost her Arkansas accent for the years they moved to Michigan during the Depression and worked, Grandpa worked in the car factories. So I had that voice already. And I knew a lot about the territory. And my husband and I love music. So we spent a lot of time in Branson, and he just drove me all over through the hills, down into the hollows and place. Oh, we got lost. And he never gets lost. He's a pilot. He never gets lost, but we got lost. And we explored caves. We did hands-on stuff again. And I did all kinds of the very, very fun things to do research, and including buying coloring books to color the dresses that were from the women's magazines of those days. And I have very poor vision, so I don't retain visual images very easily. And so coloring those dresses, it imprints it in your brain. So lots of ways to do research. I had my grandma's recipes, and I began making them, all these kinds of things. It was about a year, and then I started writing. And no, there's nothing made up except the idea of granting a wish with a touch, which has been around forever. I see Mary Frances with her hand up.
Hi, I was curious because of the big difference of your early career and working through an agent. And then this one, it's kind of like self-published. Is that right? Or am I
it
getting
is. What would you call that, Victor? Hybrid?
Could be. I haven't looked at the contract, but yeah, it may well be.
Yeah. Okay. It's hybrid. So Open Road Integrated Media, which is a large publisher in New York, has the contract on it. Mm-hmm. But they did it as a partner with us in a way. And we didn't, they did the cover, they did, you know, they did everything. So mm-hmm. that was good. Not my strength there. And so anyway, so yeah, it started out, we thought it was going to be a self-published, but then they became interested. And yeah, it's very different being published nowadays. Very, very difficult to break back in. And then I had that huge hiatus of, you know, 21 years by the time I got the book finished and started putting it out there in the world. Right. And they're looking at me and saying, you got to be kidding. We're going to trust you to do a book after you have not done anything for 21 years. You know, I wrote for an online magazine called Her View from Home, but that was it. And that was what I could handle with the parent care situation. And when you live in a big city, it's very, very difficult to understand what it's like when, you know, there are no meals on wheels. There are no, now we have them, but in those days we didn't. you know, your doctor's appointments are 70 miles away. You know, people, that's something they have a hard time understanding. So I'm not about to say, to talk to them and say, oh, well, if you knew how sad my life was. No, you know, that was my choice to do that. And so,
yeah, I wanted to ask because I can really relate to that, because in the early 70s, I was, you know, pursuing that kind of a, you know, try to find an agent, try to find pre-internet. Oh. And then raising children came into the picture, and I couldn't keep both going. Although I did have one publisher that wanted to see more, but then it didn't turn out. And then we moved from Montana to Michigan. And when the whole time I was in Michigan, I was focused on a completely different area, changing my life and from to a music teacher.
Wow.
My hiatus of 20 years was in that direction.
Okay.
Ironically, when I had started about the time I started writing again, I was taking care of my mother with Alzheimer's, but it was only 7 years, and the last four we were able to place her in a home.
That gives but you a lot more time. Yeah.
I could really relate to that. Cleaning the toilets and washing the feet, wiping the backside, all of that. And after I had tried self-publishing, I kind of ended up in a semi-hybrid situation too. I have a small publisher now in Oregon who works with me and gets does the covers or contracts with artists, but I get some say in it.
That's good.
I really appreciate hearing your whole story, because it's given me a lot of encouragement.
Thank you. Other questions? I can't see everybody. I don't know.
What about your writing process? Do you write every day, and for how long?
I do, if it's at all possible. I write Monday through Friday, and I write in the mornings because my mind is always clearer in the mornings. And so that really starts my day with a big smile, because that's exactly what I want to do, is write. If I'm writing first draft, I can only write 2 or 3 hours, and then my brain just seems to be dead. If I'm writing, you know, fourth, fifth, I usually do 6 drafts for every book, and that's easier. Or if I'm just doing a line edit, you know, I can work 6 hours, but I'm not one of those authors who can work 12 or 14 hours. I read the Danielle Steele, you know, hides away in a hotel room, and, you know, has her meals brought to her and everything. Well, that wouldn't be very possible for me, but and she writes a book in a month. There's no way in the world I could do that. And anyways, so I slog away. It takes me a year or two to write a book. So I've just finished a chapter book for middle readers, fourth, fifth, sixth graders, and it took less time because it's only 32,000-33,000 words. So that was much less. And also a book that has deeper, I like to think this book has some very deep metaphors in it, but when you're weaving those into historical facts and history, it's a lot easier to trip yourself up. And so that book was about a year, but the other books take me longer, especially if I have new research to do. And by the way, with the research question, then when I start writing the book and go through after first draft, which is hideous, my first drafts are hideous, then I do fill in research as needed.
Mm-hmm. One last question. So was China Creed a real person, or was is it more of a historical fiction?
It's historical fiction. It's not. No, the story is fiction. The setting is real as I could make it. As what Missouri was in those days and what New York City was in those days. And all the things they used. And I'm sure I have mistakes in those books, because it's so easy to just assume something is like it is nowadays when you're a modern person. And then you think, oh my goodness, why did they think they would have had an electric potato peeler? you just, why would I think that? But you just assume, I shouldn't coat all authors with the same brush paint. But anyway, that's what it is. She is made up. And I don't know anyone like China Creed. I love her dearly. My great grandma is Ms. Settle. And Victor's seen a picture of my great grandma. She looked very native. She died when I was 12. So she was also a big part of my life. And she was feisty. Oh my goodness, she was feisty. And so Miss Settle is based on her. And of course, like I said, the narration voice and also the word choices of the characters is much based on my grandfather's speech patterns and his accent.
Awesome.
The one thing I really like about your book, Sue, is I like the way, I mean, I like it and I love the way you write it, but you make these men characters. It's so accurate and they're so bad, but it was part of the thing. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how you do it. Like,
oh my gosh.
I mean, that's the thing that got me. You're like right from the beginning, like right when she was having that first girl having the baby and the way the guy was, I was like, wow, like you, how did you do that? How did you get these men so accurate? Yeah, right? Dorothy, spot on.
Well, thank you for that. That's very encouraging. It's very difficult for me to write.
I just had to say that.
But I've had some men in my life that were extraordinarily difficult. And I'm not going to name any names, but thank goodness one of them is not my husband, not my father, not my brothers, but I have had some very difficult men in my life that have really narcissistic tendencies. And so with a man that is not good, I think I rely on that narcissism as a core of his personality and then kind of go out from there. But I think it's also very important to realize that because I grew up in Pickford, a farming community, and we came in from outside when I was 4 and a half, 5, I realized that the generations here in Pickford is a wonderful town. It's why I've stayed. But the men had an entitlement feeling back in what would have been, you know, my grandfather's generation, perhaps. And I knew those men as I was growing up. I saw them at church crowd in front of all the kids in the potluck dinner and take all the good stuff, you know, and that kind of stuff. And I remember just sitting there going, what is wrong with these guys? Why doesn't anybody say anything to them? And I was just a little kid, you know, because that is not how we lived in my house or in my family. But I think I don't know if it goes back to Europe, because they weren't too many generations away from Europe. I don't know. But I think it's fairly common with some of the farm families and around here, not anymore, but way back. And I mean, that's the way it was. But I also knew a lot of women who were that way too, who ruled the roost and were not fun to be around and complained and whined all the time. And they were just as difficult as the men. So I don't necessarily think it was all men, because boy, there's been a lot of wonderful men that I grew up with. And one taught me to ride horses, and one taught me to water ski, and they were good folks, and they were encouragers, and so they were just old guys.
Yeah, thank you for your answer. But yeah, that was one thing that just really impressed me. I thought you just got those characters and the
Thank
everything
you.
was perfect. I really enjoyed the it was very realistic, and
Thank
I
you.
like that. It wasn't easy to read, but it was very real, and I thought that was great.
Well, that's kind of the goal, I think, for all of us. Are a lot of writers here. So Tyler was here, John is here, Mary Frances, right? And there's more of you. Sharon's here, that are writers. And that's one of your goals, is to just make it as real as possible. And you have to just step into that world and live there.
I love that your initial publisher wanted you to put more description into your work. So, I mean, to visualize it, like you said, it is so precious to me.
Oh, you like that. That's good. I'm glad you do. Yeah. I'm a bolder writer than I used to be, so I'm not so afraid of description, although it can overwhelm a storyline, and I think that's something that a writer has to be careful of. If you want to know how to pull a reader into a book, and that's what your goal is to pull your reader right into that world and not pop them out if at all possible. I mean, turning a page or swiping on your Kindle or your Nook or whatever you're reading it on, pops you out of the story temporarily. The end of a chapter does. So the writer has to try to do everything possible not to pop the character or the reader out of those characters and out of the story they're living in their heads. And realism really helps keep them in, as does emotion, because there's a bridge. It's harder with my Alaska books, because there was not only a bridge for most readers, not all readers, of early Native cultures, but a bridge of place. Very few people in the earth had ever been in the Aleutian Islands. And a bridge of trying to get that reader to step into that new world. And the best bridge of all is emotion. And if they can begin to feel what the character's feeling, the heartbreak or the joy or the silliness, that just pulls you right in. And if you go away from your reader and give too many globs of description, the reader yawns and pops out of the story. So it's a delicate balancing act.
This. I know John had his hand up there with a question.
I can't see everybody, so. Hi, John.
John, you're muted. Please unmute
Oh,
yourself.
he's got his mute button on. So, John, if you can hear me, you've got to unclick your mute. It's the little in the corner, the where it says audio. Right in the left-hand corner of your screen, John. There's like a little microphone that says audio, and right now it's got a red line on it. Click on it, and the red line will come off. No, he's still. Do you? I'm not sure if he sees it.
Am I on now?
Now we can hear you, John. Go ahead, John.
There are some people like me to be on the mute button. I wanted to ask you, sir, about. Well, you've written about different places other than the UP, but how does your life as a Uper influence your writing?
That's a wonderful question. Huge, huge influence. I think the wilderness and the UP, a lot of it is wilderness. It is solace for me. It's comfort. And so that's part of it. And just being able to snuggle in the winter and just hibernate is a big part of it. But my father was very careful to educate his children in how to walk softly on the earth. and how to walk in the woods without making any noise, and what to look for and how to see things. And one of the reasons I decided to look into ancient Native American life in the first place was that I was looking out my kitchen window on a snowy day doing dishes, and of course all the trees have no leaves, and I looked at all the trees and I thought, oh my goodness, from this distance I can see the bark of the trees and I can tell you what each tree is, its brand, its breed, whatever, by the bark. And I thought, well, that's something that might be worthwhile. And actually it never did come up in Mother Earth, Father Sky, because they have no trees on the Aleutian Islands. But anyway, it gave me a start of thinking I might have something worthwhile to share. Because I think a lot of times as you person, especially back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, Uper was not a nice name. It wasn't a dirty name, but it was a mean name. Oh, you're just a Uper, you don't know anything. And you're embarrassed to be a Uper. And you know, because you just didn't get a very good education and you don't know very much. And all of a sudden I'm thinking, I do too know stuff. And you know, so it was that too that was an encouragement to me. Even going to college at Lake State, I remember the other students. There are so many of them, so much more brilliant than me. And just feeling very just cowed by their knowledge and by their experiences. And I had a lot of experiences that my friends growing up did not have, simply because my mom's family was from the East Coast, so we've been out there. My dad's family was from Arkansas, so we've been there. And we had that addition to our lives, plus my mother's music. She was an incredibly gifted musician, as was her brother, who was a symphony orchestra conductor. So we did have that too, but I still felt so inferior because I grew up in the UP, and of course, that's not worth much. And now I know that was so wrong. Growing up in the UP gives you so much more than you could possibly have in so many other places, because you're just living close to the earth, and the people are so good, and they're so strong, and they're so determined to live through whatever struggle they're going through. And there's lots of struggles. All you have to do is live through one way. And that made a huge difference for me when I finally woke up and said, I have had the wonderful gift of being raised in this incredible, unusual place on the earth.
May I say? I read somewhere that people in the mitten feel smug, but people in the upper hand feel superior.
Maybe we do now. I think I just radiated that, didn't I? Maybe a little smug too. Don't forget, John, you're a Uper. I don't care where you live in the
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, John. That was cute. Do we have any other questions or comments for Sue while we've got her here? Oh, no, I'm not.
Tyler's got his hand up.
Tyler. Okay, I thought I saw. I'm looking at all the little tiny.
Yeah.
Oh, there's
Well,
Tyler.
I love the book, Sue, and
Thank you.
I guess my favorite part actually was the scenes in New York, and kind of like with Evelyn's question about how did you get the men so right, but in New York, the woman, I'm trying to remember now, at the fiance's mother, I believe, she was like so evil. And
Hopefully.
I mean, I kind of wondered, like, do you have more fun making up the villains than the the heroes, because I love writing villains. They're my favorites.
You and I have that in common. I do too. I think the best villain I ever wrote is a villainess. She is Kaas, and that has a glottal stop in it because it's an Athapascan word. And Kaas is in all three books of the Storyteller Trilogy. And my favorite part was in the third book where I killed her off. And because of the way the Native American people tell their stories, I was able to kill her off many times in many ways, and which is what she deserved. And that was such a delight to write her. I have had criticism that I gave her a little bit too much time on the pages, but boy, it was fun. If I were writing the books over again, I would probably cut her back just a bit. But you have to have a villain in some way or another, or your heroine or hero doesn't have anything to overcome. And the first thing you have to do with this person that is going to be the center of your novel, who's not the villain, is to show them to the world, and they have what they have and who they are. They have an identity to themselves that they relate to the reader. And you rip their hearts out. You take everything away from them that they have. And that, again, pulls the reader into the book and keeps them in the story, because the rest of the story is how they grow and get back to even better than they were to start out. And that's what you have to do. You have to rip out a heart. And so that's the villain's job, is to rip out the heart in some way. And I mean, in the first chapter of The Midwife's Touch, you have the father, Hattius, who, you know, he gets a daughter, and his first comment is, "Shit." You know, he's mad because he's got a daughter and instead of a son. And so he's taking away his wife's joy. And then he breaks her beautiful plate. Oh. I don't know if you can see this or not. Can you see that? And that's her beautiful thing the mother does that she loves in life. And Hattius breaks it. Now, before I could use a spode plate in the book, I had to go online and find one that was a real spode plate that existed in that time. So the description of the farm in the middle, like none ever seen in the state of Missouri, is real. And so I always have something that is part of the book at the center. The sequel to this book, The Midwife's Escape, is a journal. It's a leather bound journal with handmade paper pages. And so I found that and bought it. So, you know, it doesn't cost very much. It's only like this, like, I don't know, $20-$25. It's a lot for one plate. But when you're going to base a book around it and name a girl after it, it's not bad at all. But I couldn't bear to break it. But you see, he's the villain. And of course, he gets his. And we get a slight introduction to China's gift, even when she is just a brand new baby. But it is destroying the joy or the heart of one of the main characters, which in the first chapter is the mother and the midwife, Ms. Settle. And of course, the chicken, the red chicken. anyway. That's the fun stuff.
Great question, Tyler. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't like that. I'm so glad he died. That was a good one. I don't know if I want to keep reading. You know, this guy, he's rude.
He's awful. Yeah.
But what a way to get the reader interested. Okay. Anybody else have any questions that they want to share or comments?
Terry again.
Me again.
Go ahead, Terry.
Yeah, I kind of going back to the research again. The use of the herbs and the different things found in nature. Is that something that you had some knowledge of already, or did you have to like find out, you know, research all that too?
I did have knowledge, and I do use herbs and I gather from the woods and from the roadsides for myself. And I've dyed cloth with plants, etc. And so that was part of it. But unfortunately, my research was for Michigan and for Alaska. It was not for Missouri. And I got myself into trouble a couple of different times. I'd have to go back and think, oh, that plant doesn't grow in Missouri. So what am I going to have them use for whatever, you know? And so the Missouri part of it introduced new plants to me. But also I had, again, my grandfather's background to fall back on, even though he wasn't alive when I was writing this book. It was things that he had showed us and that we had seen on the farm, in the hedgerows, et cetera. So yeah, I had some of that knowledge, but a lot of it I had to learn again. A new state. It was interesting.
Okay.
That's a fun thing to research. It really is.
Oh yes,
children's books.
Well, we have a question. So you had talked a little bit about some other books that are coming. Like this book has a sequel, and there's. Uh-huh. Can you tell us when can we buy them?
Well, the chapter book for middle readers is ready to go as of today to the publisher.
Yay.
But we don't have a title. But that way, and I do not know. It will be the first time I've worked with this particular publisher, and I have not signed a contract, so I cannot divulge. But yet, I haven't signed a contract yet, and so I'm not sure where it will be in lockstep. You know how with a publisher you are in lockstep because other people have come first, and that's the fair way to do it. And also you have to figure out what time of the year will this book likely sell the best. And that's another issue. The Midwife's Escape just came back to me from New York City last week, and I set it aside to finish up this chapter book. And it is from corrections from my New York editor. She's extraordinarily thorough. She was my editor, one of my editors for Mother Earth, Father Sky. And when she retired, she went on her own. And so she edits my books for me now. And I'm very happy about that. But she does just adult books. And so anyway, that book, there's a lot of entanglement about how we're going to do it. What we have other publishers we're looking at, and of course we have the original publisher of The Midwife's Touch, and I just need a lot of wisdom in figuring out what to do next. But it's probably 6 months away from being sent to the publisher as a completed book. At least I have a title, and it was named by my New York editor because I'm such a bad name person. So The Midwife's Escape, and it takes off right where the last chapter of this book ends, on the train.
Well, I know a lot of us will be reading it because this is wonderful. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we are at 6:59, and any last chance comments, questions, anyone? I'm kind of scanning the crowd here. You know, when you were talking, Sue, about like bringing readers into the book and into the world, all I could remember is, do you remember as a little girl, those poppet beads where you had to push real hard and then that
yes.
bead would hook up with the other bead. And then when you took it off, you had to pull really hard.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, you know, maybe no one's told you this before, but to me, you're like a poppet bead, because I was in, and it was like the first night I started reading it, I didn't want to fall asleep. And then I fell asleep, and then I woke up an hour later and I'm like, well, yeah, I'm gonna read a little more. I don't do that very often, but I think it's because you popped me in, like you say, like you're really, you're kind of in that world, and it's you want to be there because you did it full. There's lots going on. So
thank you so much. Thank you so much. And I know there are other writers here who know how that is, but, and the joy of that is that you as the writer get to live in that world. And I know one of the questions I had asked me often with Mother of Father Sky was, boy, were you relieved when you finally finished the book? Were you relieved? And I said, no, I was homesick. Mm. I was homesick because I had to leave that beautiful world, or that difficult world. It was both. But yeah, so I think a lot of, if you talk to Tyler, if you talk to others who write novels, you will... And even with short stories, if you get really tucked into it, you're homesick when you're done.
Nice. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was a wonderful hour listening to you talk about your craft and all the exciting things that have happened to you as a writer on your journey. And we're excited to be a part of it. And thank you for agreeing to talk to us and all your contributions you've made this year to the club. You're a great member and a good writer and good friend.
Thank you. Friendship's the best of all.
And for everyone else, we will see you on December 12th. It's kind of a bigger book, so you might want to get started. But I think it's been around for a while, and it is a UP Notable Classic, and it's about some very important things. We've talked about them before in some other books about what happened up in the Houghton area during 1913. So that's all for me. Victor, any final words?
Send your grandchildren, daughters, sons, everyone to dandelioncottage.org. Let's get them all signed up so they can experience the joy of writing.
Okay. And thank you again. For giving us a book to read. And everybody have a good night.
You've been watching the UP Notable Books Club, brought to you by the Upper Peninsula Publisher and Authors Association. To join or for more information, please visit us at www.upa.org or www.upnotable.com.